welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is Stalin's Willing Executioners, which is a book review of The Jewish Century, reviewed by Professor Kevin MacDonald. A persistent theme among critics of Jews, particularly those on the pre-World War II right, has been that the Bolshevik Revolution was a Jewish revolution and that the Soviet Union was dominated by Jews. This theme appears in a wide range of writings, from Henry Ford's International Jew to published statements by a long list of British, French and American political figures in the 1920s, Winston Churchill, Woodrow Wilson and David Lloyd George, and in its most extreme form by Adolf Hitler, who wrote, "Now begins the last great revolution. By wresting political power for himself, the Jew casts off the few remaining shreds of disguise he still wears. The democratic plebeian Jew turns into the blood Jew and the tyrant of peoples. In a few years, he will try to exterminate the national pillars of intelligence, and by robbing the peoples of their natural spiritual leadership, will make them ripe for the slavish lot of a permanent subjugation. The most terrible example of this is Russia." This long tradition stands in sharp contradiction to the official view promulgated by Jewish organizations and almost all contemporary historians that Jews played no special role in Bolshevism and indeed were specifically victimized by it. Yuri Slezkin's book provides a much needed resolution to these opposing perspectives. It is an intellectual tour de force, alternately muddled and brilliant, courageous and apologetic. One of the muddled elements, apparent at the beginning and present throughout the Jewish century, is Slezkin's claim that the peoples of the world can be classified into two groups. The successful peoples of the modern world, termed Mercurians, are urban, mobile, literate, articulate and intellectually sophisticated. Distinguished by their ability to manipulate symbols, they pursue wealth for the sake of learning, and learning for the sake of wealth, and both wealth and learning for their own sake. Since Slezkin sees Jews as the quintessential Mercurians, he regards modernization as essentially a process of everyone becoming Jewish. His second group, which he calls Apollonians, are rooted in the land and in traditional agrarian cultures and prize physical strength and warrior values. Slezkin conceptualizes Mercurianism as a worldview, and therefore a matter of psychological choice rather than as a set of psychological mechanisms, the most important of which is general intelligence. As a result of this false premise, he exaggerates the similarity among Mercurians, underestimates the power of ethnocentrism as a unifying factor in Jewish history, and fails to understand the roots of Western social and economic institutions. Slezkin views Judaism as one of many Mercurian cultures, peoples that dwell alone in diasporas, living among strangers and often acting as economic middlemen, the overseas Chinese, Indians and Lebanese, and the Gypsies and Irish travellers. Their common denominator, in Slezkin's view and mine, is their status as strangers to the people they live among, sojourners who, above all else, do not intermarry or socialize with the locals. Their interactions with the local Apollonians involve mutual hostility, suspicion and contempt, and a sense of superiority. Moreover, a common host stereotype of the Mercurians is that they are devious, acquisitive, greedy, crafty, pushy, and crude. The Mercurians possess greater kin solidarity and internal cohesion than the people they live among. They are characterized by extended families and patriarchal social organization. So far, so good. Although I would stress that the family organization of such groups derives more from the long-term adaptation to the culture areas they originate from than from an adaptation to the nomadic middleman niche. But Slezkin maintains that Mercurians are, above all, smarter than the people they live among. They are said to possess cunning intelligence. But it is surely a mistake to consider such disparate groups as Jews, or the overseas Chinese, and gypsies or the Irish travellers as having in common a particular set of intellectual traits. After all, the Jews, as Sleskin shows, have repeatedly become an academic, intellectual, cultural and economic elite in Western societies, while gypsies have tended towards illiteracy and are at best an economically marginal group. Sleskin imagines that the gypsies and literate middleman groups like the Jews or overseas Chinese differ not in intelligence, but only in whether they express their intelligence through literacy or an oral culture. Businessmen, diplomats, doctors, and psychotherapists are literate peddlers, heralds, healers, and fortune tellers, a formulation that will not stand the test of current psychometric data. In fact, the general patterns of gypsies are the opposite of Jews, a low investment, low IQ reproductive style characterized by higher fertility, earlier onset of sexual behavior and reproduction, more unstable pair bonds, higher rate of single parenting, shorter interval of birth spacing, higher infant mortality rate, and higher rate of survival of low birth weight infants. Intelligence, for Sleskin, is a lifestyle choice, rather than a set of brain processes underlying information processing and strongly influenced by genetic variation. As we shall see, this formulation is very useful to Sleskin as he constructs his argument later in the book. In his attempt to paint with a very broad brush, Sleskin also ignores other real differences among the Mercurians, most notably, I would argue, the aggressiveness of the Jews compared to the relative passivity of the overseas Chinese. Both the Jews and the overseas Chinese are highly intelligent and entrepreneurial, but the overseas Chinese have not formed a hostile cultural elite in southern Asian countries, where they have chiefly settled, and have not been concentrated in media ownership or in the construction of culture. We do not read of Chinese cultural movements disseminated in the major universities and media outlets that subject the traditional culture of Southeast Asians and anti-Chinese sentiment to radical critique, or of Chinese organizations campaigning for the removal of native cultural and religious symbols from public places. Sleskin paints Jews as deeply involved in the construction of culture and in the politics of the host societies. But the role of the Chinese was quite different. The following passage describing the political attitudes of the overseas Chinese in Thailand could never have applied to Jews in Western societies since the Enlightenment. But few seem to know, or indeed to care, about the restrictions on citizenship, nationality rights, and political activities in general, nor are these restrictions given much publicity in the Chinese press. This merely points up the fact recognized by all observers that the overseas Chinese are primarily concerned with making a living or amassing a fortune, and thus take only a passive interest in the formal political life of the country in which they live. Moreover, Sleskin pictures the middlemen as specializing in certain dangerous, marvelous, and distasteful, but nevertheless indispensable, pursuits. A formulation that carries a grain of truth, as in places where natives were prohibited from loaning money at interest. However, he ignores, or at least fails to spell out, the extent to which Jews have been willing agents of exploitative elites, not only in Western societies but in the Muslim world as well. This is the overarching generalization which one can make about Jewish economic behavior over the ages. Their role went far beyond performing tasks deemed inappropriate for the natives for religious reasons. Rather, they were often tasks at which natives would be relatively less ruthless in exploiting their fellows. This was especially the case in Eastern Europe, where economic arrangements such as tax farming, estate management, and monopolies on retail liquor distribution lasted far longer than in the West. In this way, the Jewish arrendator became the master of life and death over the population of entire districts, and having nothing but a short-term and purely financial interest in the relationship, was faced with the irresistible temptation to pair his temporary subjects to the bone. On the noble estates, he tended to put his relatives and co-religionists in charge of the flour mill, the brewery, and in particular of the lord's taverns, where by custom the peasants were obliged to drink. On the church estates, he became the collector of all ecclesiastical dues, standing by the church door for his payment from the tithe payers, baptised infants, newlyweds and mourners. On the royal estates, he became in effect the crown agent, farming out the tolls, taxes and courts and adorning his oppressions with all the dignity of royal authority. Jewish involvement in the communist elite of the USSR can be seen as a variation on an ancient theme in Jewish culture, rather than a new one sprung from the special circumstances of the Bolshevik Revolution. Rather than being the willing agents of exploitative non-Jewish elites, who were clearly separated from both the Jews and the people they ruled, Jews became an entrenched part of an exploitative and oppressive elite in which group boundaries were blurred. This blurring of boundaries was aided by four processes all covered by Sleskin: shedding overt Jewish identities in favour of a veneer of international socialism, in which Jewish identity and ethnic networking were relatively invisible; seeking lower profile positions in order to de-emphasise Jewish preeminence, for example Trotsky; adopting Slavic names and engaging in a limited amount of intermarriage with non-Jewish elites. Indeed, the plethora of Jewish wives among non-Jewish leaders doubtless heightened the Jewish atmosphere at the top levels of the Soviet government, given that everyone, especially Stalin, appears to have been quite conscious of ethnicity. For their part, anti-Semites have accused Jews of having implanted those of their own category as wives and husbands for influential figures and officials. By emphasising the necessity and distastefulness of traditional Jewish occupations, Sleskin also ignores the extent to which Jewish competition suppressed the formation of a native middle class in Eastern Europe. This has also occurred throughout Southeast Asia because of competition from the overseas Chinese. Instead, Sleskin sees Eastern Europeans through stereotypical lenses, as quintessential Apollonians, some of whom became Mercurian modernists when forced to by circumstances, rather than as containing elements that would have naturally aspired to and competently performed the economic and cultural functions that instead came to be performed by Jews, because of their ability to create ethnic monopolies in goods and services. When Jews won the economic competition in early modern Poland, the result was that the great majority of Poles were reduced to the status of agricultural labourers supervised by Jewish estate managers in an economy in which trade, manufacturing and artisanry were in large part controlled by Jews. On the other hand, in most of Western Europe, Jews had been expelled in the Middle Ages. As a result, when modernisation occurred, it was accomplished with an indigenous middle class. If, as in Eastern Europe, Jews had won the economic competition in most of these professions, there would not have been a non-Jewish middle class in England. Whatever one imagines might have been the fortunes and character of England, with predominantly Jewish artisans, merchants and manufacturers, it seems reasonable to suppose that the Christian taxpayers of England made a good investment in their own future when they agreed to pay King Edward I a massive tax of £116,346 in return for expelling 2,000 Jews in 1290. When Sleskin's treatment overemphasizes middlemen as a societal necessity rather than as ethnic outsiders competing for scarce resources, he does note that the rise of the Jews in the USSR came at the expense of the Germans as a Mercurian minority in Russia prior to the revolution. Jews were excluded from traditional Russia, apart from the Pale of Settlement, which included Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarusia, Crimea, and part of Poland. Germans manned the imperial bureaucracy, formed a large percentage of professionals, entrepreneurs, and artisans, were more literate than the Russians, and had a sense of cultural superiority and ethnic solidarity. And so they were, mutatis mutandis, head to the Russian heart, mind to the Russian soul, consciousness to Russian spontaneity. They stood for calculation, efficiency and discipline, cleanliness, fastidiousness and sobriety, pushiness, tactlessness and energy, sentimentality, love of family and unmanliness, or absurdly exaggerated manliness. Perhaps paradoxically, in light of what would happen in the 20th century, Germans were occupationally and conceptually the Jews of ethnic Russia, as well as much of Eastern Europe. Or rather, the Russian Germans were to Russia what the German Jews were to Germany, only much more so. So fundamental were the German Mercurians to Russia's view of itself that both their existence and their complete and abrupt disappearance had been routinely taken for granted. Although the replacement of Germans by Jews was well underway by the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, a key consequence of the revolution was the substitution of one Mercurian group, the Germans, by another, the Jews. The difference between the Jews and the Germans was that the Jews had a long-standing visceral antipathy, out of past historical grievances, both real and imagined, towards the people and culture they came to administer. Indeed, Russians on the nationalist right admired the Germans, at least up to World War I. For example, a statue of one nationalist organization, Michael the Archangel, Russian People's Union, expressed particular trust in the German population of the empire, while its leader, Vladimir Perushkevich, accused the Jews of irreconcilable hatred of Russia and everything Russian. Jews disliked the Christian religion of the vast majority of Russians because of the antagonistic relationship between Judaism and Christianity over the ages. Jews distrusted the peasants who fell from grace, with the intelligentsia after the numerous anti-Jewish pogroms, especially after 1880, and Jews blamed the Tsar for not doing enough to keep the peasants in check and for imposing the various quotas on Jewish advancement that went into place, also beginning in the 1880s, quotas that slowed down but by no means halted Jewish overrepresentation in the universities and professions. In this respect, the Germans were far more like the overseas Chinese, in that they became an elite without having an aggressively hostile attitude towards the people and culture they administered and dominated economically. Thus, when Jews achieved power in Russia, it was as a hostile elite with a deep sense of historical grievance. As a result, they became willing executioners of both the people and cultures they came to rule, including the Germans. After the revolution, not only were the Germans replaced, but there was active suppression of any remnants of the older order and their descendants. Jews have always shown a tendency to rise because their natural proclivities, example high intelligence, and powerful ethnic networking. But here they also benefited from anti-bourgeois quotas in educational institutions and other forms of discrimination against the middle class and aristocratic elements of the old regime that would have provided more competition with Jews. In a letter intercepted by the secret police, the father of a student wrote that his son and their friends were about to be purged from the university because of their class origins. It is clear that only the Jerusalem academics and the Communist Party members generally are going to stay. The bourgeois elements from the previous regime, including the ethnic Germans, would have no future. Thus, the mass murder of peasants and nationalists was combined with the systematic exclusion of the previously existing non-Jewish middle class. The wife of a Leningrad university professor noted, "In all the institutions, only workers and Israelites are admitted. The life of the intelligentsia is very hard." Even at the end of the 1930s, prior to the Russification that accompanied World War II, the Russian Federation was still doing penance for its imperial past, while also serving as an example of an ethnicity-free society. While all other nationalities, including Jews, were allowed and encouraged to keep their ethnic identities, the revolution remained an anti-majoritarian movement. Slezkin is aware of the biological reality of kinship and ethnicity, but he steadfastly pursues a cultural determinist model. He argues that biological models of ethnic nepotism are inappropriate because some nomadic groups are not kin groups, but rather quasi-families like the Sicilian Mafia. But this is a distinction without a difference. Why are natural kinship groups significantly different from groups composed of families that band together? Each is characterized by internal cohesion and external strangeness, the traits Slezkin deems essential. But there are also kinship connections and a genetic divide between themselves and surrounding peoples. Cultural badges of group membership and a culturally generated ideology of kin group membership are age-old ways of cementing kinship groups, and setting up barriers that mark real biological differences. The evolved psychology described by modern research in social identity theory. And in any case, the demonstrable genetic differences between Sleskin's prototypical Mercurians, the Jews, Gypsies, and overseas Chinese, and the surrounding peoples cry out for a biological analysis. Moreover, Sleskin underestimates the power of ethnocentrism as a unifying factor in Jewish history. This is most apparent in his discussion of Israel, which he describes as a radical departure from the Jewish tradition, because Israel is a quintessentially Apollonian society. Long after Western societies had rejected ethnic nationalism, Israel continued to live in the European 1930s, only Israel still belonged to the eternally young, worshipped athleticism and inarticulateness, celebrated combat and secret police, promoted hiking and scouting, despised doubt and introspection, embodied the seamless unity of the chosen, and rejected most traits traditionally associated with Jewishness. After 2,000 years of living as Mercurians among Apollonians, Jews turned into the only Apollonians in a world of Mercurians, or rather, the only civilized Apollonians in a world of Mercurians and barbarians. But Israelis certainly did not reject traditional Jewish ethnocentrism and sense of peoplehood. Sleskin portrays Israelis as simply choosing to be ethnocentric nationalists, but ethnocentrism, like intelligence, is a biological system, not a lifestyle choice, and traditional diaspora Jews were certainly deeply and intensely ethnocentric above all else. There can be little question that Israel and Zionism have been and are promoted and spearheaded by the most ethnocentric elements of the Jewish community. For Sleskin, as for so many Jews, the moral debt owed to Jews by Western societies justifies the most extreme expressions of Jewish racialism. The rhetoric of ethnic homogeneity and ethnic deportations, tabooed elsewhere in the West, is a routine element of Israeli political life. It is true that no other European nation is in a condition of permanent war. It is also true that no other European state can have as strong a claim on the West's moral imagination. Sleskin sees the moral taboo on European ethnocentrism, the creation of Nazism as the epitome of absolute evil, and the consecration of Jews as the chosen people of the post-war Western world, as simply the inevitable results of the events of World War II. In fact, however, the creation and maintenance of the culture of the Holocaust and the special moral claims of Jews and Israel are the result of Jewish ethnic activism. These claims have a specific historical trajectory. They are fueled by specific key events, and they are sustained by specific forces. For example, the Holocaust was not emphasized as a cultural icon until the late 1960s and early 1970s, when images of the Holocaust were deployed on a large scale in popular culture by Jewish activists, specifically to rally support for Israel in the context of its wars of 1967 and 1973. Similarly, Sleskin sees the United States as a Jewish promised land precisely because it is not defined tribally and has no state-bearing natives. But the recasting of the United States as a proposition nation was importantly influenced by the triumph of several Jewish intellectual and political movements, more than it was a natural and inevitable culmination of American history. These movements collectively delegitimized cultural currents of the early 20th century, whereby many Americans thought of themselves as members of a very successful ethnic group. For example, the immigration restrictionists of the 1920s unabashedly asserted the right of European-derived peoples to the land they had conquered and settled. Americans of Northern European descent in the United States thought of themselves as part of a cultural and ethnic heritage extending backwards in time to the founding of the country, and writers like Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard had a large public following. At that time, both academia and mainstream culture believed in the reality of race, that there were important differences between the races, including in intelligence and moral character, and that races naturally competed for land and other resources. The assertion that Israel is the only civilized Apollonian society, Despite its acknowledged racialism and open discussion of ethnic deportations, reveals Sleskin's belief in Jewish moral and intellectual superiority. Indeed, Sleskin regards both European individualism and the European nation-state as imitations of pre-existing Jewish accomplishments. Europeans imitated Jews not only in being modern, meaning by becoming individualists interacting with strangers, but also in being ancient, meaning by developing ethnically based nation-states. So we read condescending passages such as, among the most successful of the European Mercurians were Max Weber's Protestants, who discovered a humorless, dignified way to be Jewish. This act of intellectual gymnastics depends on the following analogy. Jews act as an ethnically based tribe within societies, seeing non-Jews as strangers. Europeans establish tribal nation-states while behaving as individualists within their societies, seeing other Europeans as strangers. The sweeping conclusion? Jews are the progenitors, therefore, of both aspects of modernity, economic individualism and the ethnically based nation-state. The Holocaust then occurred because the European nation-state, although an imitation of Judaism, failed somehow to be sufficiently Jewish. In the hands of heavily armed, thoroughly bureaucratized and imperfectly Judaized Apollonians, Mercurian exclusivity and fastidiousness became relentlessly expansive. In the hands of messianically inclined Apollonians, it turned lethal, especially to the Mercurians. The Holocaust had as much to do with tradition as it did with modernity. But it is a huge stretch to argue from an analogy, and a loose one at that, to actual imitation and influence. And one just doesn't know what to say about his claim that Europeans perpetrated the Holocaust because they had become imperfect Jews. Sleskin fails to provide any evidence that there is anything but a hazy and forced logical connection between European individualism and the Jewish role as a diaspora people living among strangers. The reality is that by becoming individualists, Western Europeans returned to distinctive roots buried in their primeval past, whereas Judaism, because of its deep-seated tribalism, was widely regarded by Enlightenment intellectuals as an outmoded relic. Indeed, several Jewish commentators have noted that the post-Enlightenment forms of Judaism have essentially been responses to the corrosive effects of European civilization, with its emphasis on individualism and ethnic assimilation, on Judaism as an ethnically based collectivist group, what early Zionist Arthur Ruppin described as the destructive influence of European civilization on Judaism because of its tendency to break down group barriers and lead eventually to assimilation and intermarriage. Moreover, as Sleskin notes, Jews are not really individualists at all. Even in the modern world, the tribal approach of the Jews in economic enterprises employs ethnic kinship as a central component, whereas the individualist approach of the Europeans sees this as illegitimate. The bottom line is that it is ridiculous to claim that Jews are individualists because they treat outsiders as individuals, while acknowledging that they retain a powerful in-group consciousness and are masters of ethnic networking. It is no stretch at all, however, to show that Jews have achieved a preeminent position in Europe and America, and Sleskin provides us with statistics of Jewish domination only dimly hinted at in the following examples from Europe in the late 19th century to the rise of National Socialism. Austria. All but one bank in fin de siècle Vienna was administered by Jews, and Jews constituted 70% of the Stock Exchange Council. Hungary. Between 50 and 90% of all industry was controlled by Jewish banking families, and 71% of the most wealthy taxpayers were Jews. Germany. Jews were overrepresented among the economic elite by a factor of 33. Similar massive overrepresentation was also to be found in educational attainment and among professionals. For example, Jews constituted 62% of the lawyers in Vienna in 1900, 25% in Prussia in 1925, 34% in Poland, and 51% in Hungary. Indeed, the universities, free professions, salons, coffee houses, concert halls, and art galleries in Berlin, Vienna, and Budapest became so heavily Jewish that liberalism and Jewishness became almost indistinguishable. Slezkin documents the well-known fact that, as Moritz Goldstein famously noted in 1912, we Jews administer the spiritual possessions of Germany. However, he regards Jewish cultural dominance, not only in Germany, but throughout Eastern Europe and Austria, as completely benign. The secular Jews' love of Goethe, Schiller, and the other Pushkins, as well as the various northern forests they represented, was sincere and tender. Their only sin was that their love of cultural icons transcended national and ethnic boundaries in an age of popular nationalism. For example, their promotion of German culture among the Czechs, Latvians, and Romanians. But this is far from the whole story. Jews were not simply lovers of Pushkin and Goethe. A major theme of anti-Jewish attitudes was that Jews were deeply involved in creating a culture of critique, that Jewish cultural influence was entirely negative and shattered the social bonds of the peoples they lived among. Slezkin cites Heinrich Heine as a prime example of a Jewish intellectual with sincere and tender love for German culture. But the Germans, from Wagner to von Tschitschke to Chamberlain and Hitler, did not see it that way. For example, Heinrich von Tschitschke, a prominent 19th century German intellectual, complained of Heine's mocking German humiliation and disgrace following the Napoleonic Wars, and Heine's having no sense of shame, loyalty, truthfulness, or reverence. Nor does he mention von Tschitschke's comment that what Jewish journalists write in mockery and satirical remarks against Christianity is downright revolting. About the shortcomings of the Germans or French, everybody could freely say the worst things, but if somebody dared to speak in just and moderate terms about some undeniable weakness of the Jewish character, he was immediately branded as a barbarian and a religious persecutor by nearly all of the newspapers. Such attitudes were prominent among anti-Jewish writers and activists, reaching a crescendo with the National Socialists in Germany. Yet for Slezkin, if Jews did battle against various national cultures, and in the end he acknowledges that they did, it was only because they realised that their Mercurian worldview was superior. Did they really want to transform themselves into thick-skulled peasants, now that the actual peasants had, for all practical purposes, admitted the error of their ways? Jews were not recognised as legitimate curators of the national culture, but their lack of acceptance means only that they are truly modern, deprived of the comforts of their tribe, and not allowed into the new ones created by their Apollonian neighbours, they became the only true moderns. A statement that accepts at face value the idea that the secular Jews, who had become the custodians and main producers of culture, had ceased to have a Jewish identification. Slezkin fails to provide any evidence at all for this claim. And in fact, there is overwhelming evidence that it is false. The main weapons Jews used against national cultures were two quintessentially modern ideologies, Marxism and Freudianism, both of which countered nationalism's quaint tribalism with a modern scientific path to wholeness. Slezkin correctly views both of these as Jewish ideologies functioning as organized religions, with sacred texts promising deliverance from earthly travail. While most of his book recounts the emergence of a Jewish elite under the banner of Marxism in the Soviet Union, his comments on psychoanalysis bear mentioning. Psychoanalysis moved to the United States to reinforce democratic citizenship with a much-needed new prop. In America, where nationwide tribal metaphors could not rely on theories of biological descent, Freudianism came in very handy indeed. By erecting the explicitly therapeutic state. The establishment of the explicitly therapeutic state was much aided by yet another Jewish intellectual movement, the Frankfurt School, which combined psychoanalysis and Marxism. The result was a culture of critique, which fundamentally aimed not only at delegitimizing the older American culture, but even attempted to alter or obliterate human nature itself. The statistical connection between the Jewish question and the hope for a new species of mankind seems fairly strong. And when people don't cooperate in becoming a new species, there's always murder. Slezkin describes Walter Benjamin, an icon of the Frankfurt School and darling of the current crop of postmodern intellectuals, with glasses on his nose, autumn in his soul, and vicarious murder in his heart. a comment that illustrates the fine line between murder and cultural criticism, especially when engaged in by ethnic outsiders. Indeed, on another occasion, Benjamin stated, "Hatred and the spirit of sacrifice are nourished by the image of enslaved ancestors rather than that of liberated grandchildren." Although Sleskin downplays this aspect of Jewish motivation, Jews' lachrymose perceptions of their history, their images of enslaved ancestors, were potent motivators of the hatred unleashed by the upheavals of the 20th century. Sleskin is entirely correct that Marxism, psychoanalysis, and the Frankfurt School were fundamentally Jewish intellectual movements. However, he fails to provide anything like a detailed account of how these ideologies served specifically Jewish interests, most generally in combating anti-Semitism and subverting ethnic identification among Europeans. Indeed, a major premise of his treatment is that Jewish radicals were not Jews at all. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part two of Stalin's Willing Executioners here at RadioAlbion.com.